Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, what is the United Nations Human Rights Council, and is it dominated by human rights violators? And first, is Turkey using ISIS as a cover for a war against its Kurdish population? While its leadership promised the West to help in a war against ISIS, it has recently launched some 300 airstrikes against the Kurdish PKK and rounded up more than 1,000 members of another pro-Kurdish group, the Kurdish People's Democratic Party, according to The Independent. It has also arrested and detained scores of local journalists and recently arrested three Vice News reporters for allegedly siding with the Kurds. With us is Nathan Robinson. He's a civil rights lawyer, a contributor to The Nation, and a PhD candidate. He recently published an article titled, Turkey is Using ISIS as a Cover for Its War Against Kurdish Activists in The Nation. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Nathan Robinson. Great to have you here with us.
Thank you.
You've written this piece about Turkey using ISIS essentially as cover to attack its Kurdish people. I thought maybe we should start with the internal background of what's going on inside of Turkey with the elections and the politics there. How would you describe that?
Absolutely. There's some political context here because Turkey is under a conservative Islamist government under President Erdogan and the ruling party there. And it's been interesting because in the last couple of years, there's been a lot of dissent in Turkey, a lot of reaction. Turkey's an interesting country because, you know, it's got such a wide mixture of people. It's both European and Middle Eastern. And in 2013, you saw this huge protest in Gezi Park, which was sort of the Turkish equivalent of the Occupy movement, but much larger, a real powerful force mobilizing against the government in opposition to its rule. So those protests spread throughout the country, and there was a brutal crackdown on those protests by the government. And it was successful in the short run in solidifying their hold on power. But what happened is, in the 2 years since then, you really saw the elements of dissent that were shown there sort of came together in a political coalition. They've sort of been building power to the point where the most recent elections that you had in June of this year, there was a phenomenal success by pro-Kurdish and leftist factions in Turkey that had unified. And so that really frightened the conservative government. In fact, they were unable to form a government in this election. So there are new elections scheduled for November. And so the context of this is that the conservative Turkish government was frightened because pro-Kurdish and leftist parties had been really showing some force.
So now let's turn to the Kurds and the plight of the Kurds. In your article in The Nation, you described sort of an experimental direct democracy in that region that we call Kurdistan. First of all, describe the region and then describe what this direct democracy looks like. What have they been doing?
We're talking about the border of Turkey and Syria. So we're talking about an area that spans some of northern Syria and some of southern Turkey. And it's largely Kurdish, but And in that area, that's been where the Kurdish fight against ISIS has been concentrated. So there's a sort of three-way conflict between the Kurds, ISIS in Syria, and the Turkish government, although mainly between the Kurds and the Turkish government and ISIS, rather than the Turkish government and ISIS. So, interestingly, there's always been a sort of leftist strain in the Kurdish movement, and what you've seen is an evolution in some sectors of the Kurdish left from a more traditional kind of Marxism to a kind of a more open and participatory socialism. And it's very influenced by, it's very heavily feminist, very dominated by women, and very committed to LGBT rights. I mean, it's really unique in the Middle East, and they've been sort of experiments popping up in the Rojava region that have been quite inspiring, but that have been difficult to sustain.
When you say they're socialist and feminist, what specifically makes you say these two particular strands?
Well, I mean, this is their own way of describing themselves. It's true that this is the rhetoric that's used, and this is not only the rhetoric that's used, but this is the way things are implemented. There's an attempt to give power to municipal councils and to keep power local and to make sure that everyone has an equal participation in the decision-making process. So, you know, it's both current, these are currents of ideas that are in the air, and they're also sort of the way that Kurdish political practice is sort of evolving in reality.
And then can you also, before we get into what happened with the bomb attack, help us to understand the politics of the different Kurdish groups and how they fit in the geopolitics? There's the YPG, for example, the PKK. Parse that out.
I mean, it's not essential to the understanding of this particular instance, but it is important to note the Turkish government essentially sees all of Kurdistan as the enemy, and so doesn't really make too many distinctions among these groups. But it's true that you have the PKK, who are more officially Marxist and are more a left-wing group, and you have other Kurdish armed groups that are less explicitly socialist. But I think the important point for the purpose of understanding this story is that the Turkish government treats all of these the same, and these distinctions, which really, they matter quite a bit. The Turkish government sees leftism among Turks, pro-Kurdish views, among Kurds, the PKK, the YPG. They sort of see them all as the same entity, all as the enemy of Turkey.
Let's go into what happened with this particular incident and how you see this as really part of this politics between Turkey and its own Kurdish population. There was a suicide bomb attack. What happened?
So what was happening is this was an attack by ISIS on a group in Turkey who are not actually Kurdish. They're a Turkish student group. And what they are, they're a Turkish student left group. And they've been involved in this effort that, as I mentioned earlier, there's this effort to unify left, the pro-Kurdish movement and the left. And so they're a leftist Turkish group, and they've been aiming to try and build bridges with Kurdish groups. And so as part of this, they had this huge plan to go and do relief work for the city of Kobani, which is over the border in Syria, and which was under assault by ISIS for a long time and was sort of ruined by the ISIS assault, and which is still in very desperate need. And so they were going to go and help them build a kindergarten and plant trees and bring baby supplies, which are urgently needed. And so they were gathering in the southern city of Suruç, which is just over the border in Turkey. It's on the Turkish-Syrian border. And so they were gathering there, and the mood was very celebratory, and they were really looking forward to this because it was a sort of unprecedented cooperation between the Turkish left and the Kurds. And it was a really exciting opportunity to kind of build something. But on the morning they planned to go, they were attacked by ISIS, and 33 of the young activists were murdered in the bombing. And so this was a huge incident because it was the largest ISIS attack on Turkish soil in a long time. And my piece is focused largely on discussing the consequences, the fallout from this bombing, which is that ultimately what happened was the conservative government, instead of reacting to the deaths of these young people by turning on ISIS, reacted to the deaths of these young people by turning further on the Kurdish movement and on the left. And those are the very people who were attacked by ISIS. So they really got attacked twice, first by ISIS and then again by the Turkish government, who just saw this bombing as a pretext to say, well, the whole country's on fire, there's terrorism, and we need to crack down on terrorism. And when they say terrorism, they always mean the Kurds and the people who support them.
You quoted some of the people who were there in your piece, and I was struck by some of this. For example, one young Turkish student said, "Turkey is a country with a history of its own war against its own people, a history of massacres." Do you have a sense that the youth in Turkey are learning this history despite laws forbidding them from insulting Turkey?
I think that's absolutely true. We're in an age where information flows pretty freely, and the Turkish government has been very restrictive. Obviously, there are laws against insulting the president. Obviously, there are laws against speaking out in favor of the Kurdish movement. And I talked to people who said they knew people who have been arrested for singing Kurdish songs. And so there's all of that. But it really is, I mean, I was able to communicate freely with these people online and talk to them, and so it's increasingly harder for even an authoritarian government, I think, to actually suppress history. I mean, Wikipedia has an article which is specifically list of historical massacres in Turkey, and anyone in Turkey can go to that page and read that page. They recommended that page to me. So I think the history is increasingly known, and maybe that's part of how they are able to form this kind of opposition. I don't know. But certainly they're very, very conscious of how the government treats people who are different and who are dissenters.
You also mentioned that these oppressions of political minorities, specifically this group that you were talking about and interviewing, that there had been raids on their homes. What happened there?
So what happened was, in the aftermath of this bombing occurred on July 20th, and in the few weeks after that, what immediately happened was the Turkish government essentially treated the country as if it was in a state of emergency. They said, well, you know, we have to initiate a new war against terror. And so they did one day of airstrikes against ISIS, just to show that they were serious about ISIS. But then for the subsequent 3 weeks, they forgot about ISIS, and they immediately turned on the pro-Kurdish factions on the left. And the way that played out in practice was you had them, as I said, they've been raiding homes, they've been doing a lot of arbitrary arrests and detention. They said they'd arrested, quote, 1,000 terrorists. They called them terrorists, that was their quote. But they... But in fact, when you look at who the supposed terrorists that they arrested were, they were overwhelmingly people of the left and people who are sympathetic to the Kurdish movement, not people who are Islamist extremists and part of ISIS. So there have been hundreds and hundreds of detentions of people who are left-wing. The government prohibited photos of the bombing from going out on social media. They also prohibited the families of some of the victims from receiving their loved ones' bodies and having a funeral, because they thought that the funeral would animate opposition to the Turkish government, because people there really do blame the Turkish government for the actions of ISIS here, because they believe that the Turkish government was essentially complicit by allowing ISIS to freely operate and by not really caring very much about ISIS, because ISIS's actions against the Kurds and now against the Turkish left really worked to the government's benefit. So, yeah, they've really stepped up repressive measures in the aftermath of this.
So when we look at this big picture, Middle East geopolitics, Turkey has been giving sort of lip service to the West, saying it will help in this fight against ISIS. And it seems a little bit schizophrenic, if I could use that psychiatric term. I mean, how do you explain this?
It's not schizophrenic if you just think it's simple saying one thing for the West and then doing another because it's in their interest. But in Turkey, there's no real mystery. There's no real belief that the president is serious when he talks about ISIS. In fact, you can read it in his statements. If you read his statements, you have to sort of bend the interpretation to think he cares about ISIS. He openly says, we see ISIS and the Kurdish movement as being the same thing. And then that's the last he'll mention of ISIS, and then he'll just talk about the Kurdish movement for three paragraphs. So it's pretty open how serious they are about ISIS, which is not at all. And the people I talked to said in southern Turkey, essentially, ISIS has been operating openly without really any fear. And I link, actually, in the piece to an article that suggests that even when they do arrest people who are associated with ISIS, they release them very quickly. So if you're on the left or in the pro-Kurdish movement, you get detained for a while, your charges will be brought against you, you'll be brought to trial. If you're from ISIS, you're much more likely to be released. But I think the thing is that they have to keep up a good face for the West, because they know that the West sees ISIS as a major threat. And, you know, they opened up one of their air bases to be used by U.S. drones to go against ISIS. As I say, when they really come under a lot of pressure, they'll do a day of bombing. But they don't even really pretend to be serious. I mean, they make it clear who their real enemy is.
One of the things that I've noticed is that the government has arrested scores of journalists. And the most recent, just this week, were three from the American news organization Vice News, ostensibly for helping the Kurds. And they have said that pretty directly. I suppose this is yet another way of trying to control the narrative.
That's the real suspicion, right, is that there are underlying political motives for this, because everyone before the bombing believed that the president would likely do something to try and shore up power. And indeed, this has really gotten his supporters out in force. You know, they're on the streets demonstrating in support of the president. So, you know, like in any country, when you have a war, it excites a lot of patriotic fervor. And I think that the arrest of the vice journalists is two things. It's first, as you say, a suppression of communication. And it just fits with that pattern of anyone who is in any way associated, however tangentially, with the Kurdish movement is in fear of arrest. It doesn't even matter that these people were journalists. You don't have to do anything other than be suspected of perhaps harboring sympathies for the Kurdish movement, and you can be in fear of losing your liberty.
It sounds like it's much broader than just the Kurdish movement, too, from the other oppressions that are going on. I mean, you mentioned even in your article that historically the government had not cracked down as much on the LGBT movement, but now it is. Yeah. So I wonder, how is this affecting the opposition to Erdogan in its efforts to be elected? Can you get a sense of that yet?
You remember that this is an Islamist government. It's a religious government based on fundamentalist Islamic values. So to have the blossoming of a secular left that values feminism and the rights of LGBT people is a threat to the values of the dominant government. So you do see at the moment a real fear that this warlike atmosphere is going to be used to further the government's agenda in other respects, because there was a real threat that the coalition of left and pro-Kurdish forces was posing. And in this ongoing battle over an Islamic versus a secular Turkey, this is a really pivotal moment, because people who are just members of the HDP party, which is the pro-Kurdish left party, just their party membership is now becoming grounds for fear, even though they're a mainstream party that won many, many seats in the government. So, you know, they're the opposition. So this isn't just about the autonomy of Kurdistan, but this is also against the political opposition and people who are opposed to the government in a variety of ways. Because, as we know, when an atmosphere of authoritarianism really solidifies, all of the enemies of the government have reason to fear. Even people who aren't the nominal target still, as the state expands, as its military presence expands, can be victimized by this.
Well, Nathan Robinson, thank you so much for joining us here on the Scholar Circle.
Well, thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.
Nathan Robinson is a civil rights lawyer, an author, a contributor to The Nation, and a PhD candidate. When we come back, the messy politics of the United Nations Human Rights Council. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. What is the United Nations Human Rights Council? What is its charge? And is it dominated by human rights violators? That is the subject of a talk by Hillel Nour, the executive director of United Nations Watch. And he recently briefed the University of Auckland Politics Department about this subject.
Thank you very much. Next year, we are going to mark the 10th anniversary of the reform of the United Nations Human Rights Council, and also the 70th anniversary of the founding of that body in 1946, then known as the Commission on Human Rights. And so what I'd like to do today is to say a few words about the reform of 10 years ago and to ask whether on the eve of the 10th anniversary, we are meeting the benchmarks for reform that were set forth by Secretary General of the United Nations Kofi Annan back in February 2005. A few words about the history of the United Nations Human Rights Commission. It was established in 1946 by some eminent individuals. Eleanor Roosevelt was the founding chair. She was, of course, the great humanitarian of the age, the wife of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. She had a regular column in American newspapers and was the voice of the widow, the orphan, African Americans, and other minorities who otherwise did not have a voice. So she's a very fitting person to be founding chair of this new body. And she gathered with her other eminent figures, including René Cassin, the architect of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and others from around the world. And in a short space of only 2 years, they crafted a document known as the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, adopted on the 10th of December, 1948, in Paris, France, in a special session of the General Assembly. And this document sets forth the rights and freedoms that we all hold dear: freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, equality, the right against torture, the right to life, and so forth. And it's a document that has become a beacon, a torch for human rights victims and dissidents around the world. Indeed, on the 10th of December, every year, there are activists and dissidents in countries that are not free who will take to the streets and demand their freedoms, invoking that Universal Declaration. So in its early years, the United Nations Commission on Human Rights did important things. Now, I'd like to ask you here if anyone might be able to name the representatives, the persons who currently sit on the 47-member UN Human Rights Council. Can anyone tell me some of the individual persons who are representatives today? I'm not sure which, you know, maybe you mean William Schabas? Pardon?
Brilliant.
I'm not sure which person you mean, but there was the Canadian who interrupted David. I see, Mark. Well done. Yes, well done. Marius Grinius. Yes. Oh, okay. So someone was actually named someone. He's not still there. So we have a very knowledgeable individual who spent some time in Switzerland and was a friend of a departed activist who was a friend of mine, David Littman. So well done. But this is the exception that proves the rule. Most people cannot name any of the individuals, and indeed the individual you named was a diplomat who is not particularly well known for anything on human rights. Indeed, you know him because he interrupted a human rights activist and wouldn't let him speak when he was chairing a session as a representative of my country, Canada, some 6 years ago or so. The reason that most of us are unable to name the individuals who sit on the Human Rights Council is because the body changed. Whereas once it was these eminent individuals like Eleanor Roosevelt and René Cassin, today it's really a body of governments. And governments which paradoxically joined the Human Rights Council, not because of any great concern to promote human rights, but on the contrary. As the Human Rights Commission in the 1960s and 70s began to acquire more power, and when I say power, I don't mean the power of the sword, that's the Security Council, which deals with war and peace. I don't mean the power of the purse, the budget, that's the General Assembly. The Human Rights Council, the only power that it has is the power of words. But I believe that words matter. I believe that words matter. Word is father to deed. And human rights matter. And so what is said and done at the United Nations matters. And what is said and done at the Human Rights Council matters. And actually, we see that governments who have the least respect for the principles of human rights are very zealous never to be singled out, to be criticized, to be put on any kind of watch list concerning human rights at the United Nations. They invest enormous energies. And so, indeed, because of the growing influence and power of various mechanisms that would investigate countries and name names, a power they didn't have in the early years, governments said, we need to be in the room when decisions are being made whom to condemn or to criticize or to investigate. And so you had this ironic, paradoxical situation where country like Sudan, whose leader has been indicted for genocide, was a regular member of the Commission on Human Rights. China, where 1.3 billion people are denied any form of basic freedom, was a regular member of the Commission on Human Rights. And indeed, in 2003, the dictatorship of Colonel Gaddafi, the Libyan dictatorship of Colonel Gaddafi, was elected chair of the Commission on Human Rights. So 1946, Eleanor Roosevelt, 2003, Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, who ran one of the most despicable dictatorships on the planet. We knew a lot of his atrocities back in 2003 when he was elected, when he was deposed and eventually killed. In the war of 2011, we learned much more that he used to rape women and girls on campus every day and had a special room for that at the university in Libya. And he was the one whose regime, he had an ambassador in Geneva, who was chosen to be chair of the Human Rights Commission. So this really was the low point of the Commission on Human Rights, and it prompted many voices to question its credibility, typically non-governmental voices, such as Human Rights Watch. Ken Roth, the director of Human Rights Watch in 2001, commented that if you can imagine a jury of rapists, thieves, and murderers, that's what the Commission on Human Rights has become. Those who are charged to protect and promote human rights are in fact themselves the perpetrators who are meant to protect the victims, the foxes guarding the chickens. But the UN would never acknowledge this until February 2005. I'll never forget it because I was chairing a panel session at the UN Human Rights Commission. We had UN experts on the panel. We had a Canadian diplomat. We had an Irish diplomat. And we were talking about reform, and Kofi Annan's bombshell proposal titled In Larger Freedom was suddenly released. And in that proposal, a blueprint for thoroughgoing UN reform, he proposed to scrap the Commission on Human Rights. This never happened before, ever. No one ever talked about eliminating a major UN agency. Kofi Annan said that the Human Rights Commission has begun to have members who are joining not to promote and protect human rights, but rather to shield their own records of abuse and those of their allies. Just like I said, Libya being the most famous example. He didn't name names, but everyone had Colonel Gaddafi in mind. He also said that the commission was failing to do its work, that it was rife with selectivity and politicization instead of focusing on real human rights considerations, and that the situation was so bad that the commission was casting a shadow, I'm quoting, casting a shadow upon the reputation of the United Nations as a whole. Kofi Annan. And he said, we need to get rid of this body. We need a smaller council. At the time, there were 53 members on the commission, 53 countries, out of 193 in the whole UN. Only 53 would sit on the rotating membership in Geneva. And he said, we need to scrap it and create a smaller body that would elect members committed to the highest standards of human rights. A solid record of commitment, countries that have a solid record of commitment to the highest standards of human rights. His proposal, in some part, was adopted. They eliminated the Commission on Human Rights. I was there at the funeral in March 2006. And a few months later, they established a new body called the Human Rights Council. So the name was changed, and it was meant to be different. And there were some mechanisms that were new. One of them called the Universal Periodic Review, a mechanism whereby every country would have to be reviewed at least once every 4 years. Whereas before, most countries would go scot-free and never be criticized at all, the new Human Rights Council would review every single country at least once. And that was a new mechanism. There also was a more public election procedure. Countries that joined would have to campaign based on their record. Resolution 60/251 of March 2006 says that when electing countries, you must consider their record in promoting and protecting human rights. And indeed, countries that commit gross and systematic human rights violations under Article 8 of the resolution can be removed by a two-thirds majority of the General Assembly. So this was the idea of the new Human Rights Council. And now, as we're on the eve of the 10th anniversary, which will arrive there in several months, it is fitting to look back and ask whether the reforms envisioned by then Secretary General Kofi Annan have been realized or not, and to what degree. And if not, what can we do? What should we be doing to see that these reforms come to fruition, keeping in mind the cause of human rights for millions of victims around the world? So if you were to review the talking points that are issued by the United States government at the end of every session, in September we meet for a month, in March for a month, and in June, at the end of every session, like clockwork, the U.S. State Department issues a set of talking points, and it's called key outcomes from this session. and they will inevitably trumpet accomplishments. So if you ask the United States, or if you look at the EU talking points that also emerge from these sessions, there too you will see only positive headlines about accomplishments by each month-long session of the Council. And in my opinion, they have a point in citing particular accomplishments, such as, for example, the establishment of a commission of inquiry on North Korea in the past 2 years, headed by an Australian judge, Kirby, which was a very important effort to put a spotlight, a rare spotlight, on probably one of the worst human rights situations on the planet, which has largely evaded scrutiny by world attention. And the North Koreans mobilized. They tried to fight off this inquiry. There was a lot of diplomatic activity on their part and by their allies in New York City to stop it. But it went through, and activists that we work with, my organization, UN Watch, works a lot with North Korean escapees, and our Human Rights Award about 3 years ago was given to one of these escapees from a total control labor camp. And many of them were able to testify, and it was a very important effort. The Human Rights Council also revived the investigation of Iran, what's called a special rapporteur. There are about 60 or so special rapporteurs that investigate country situations or themes, and Iran is now one of those country situations being investigated by a permanent investigator. It's a volunteer position, but it's an ongoing mandate. The one who heads that position is Ahmed Shahid. He is the former foreign minister of the Maldives. Because he is Muslim and a former foreign minister, Iran in particular despises him. He has done a very good job of interviewing victims and dissidents and being a voice for their suffering and documenting the many horrific human rights abuses that continue to occur in Iran, whether against women who are subjected to a modesty police who arrest them hundreds of thousands, if not millions of times throughout the year. Gays are persecuted. The Baha'is are denied access to universities and not allowed to get education, which is very important for the Baha'i people. And as the General Assembly has noted, Iran persecutes Azeris, Baha'is, Arabs, Christians, Jews, and others. So we have a special rapporteur who does a good job of looking into them, and Iran attacks his reputation all the time. There are some other examples of achievements of the Human Rights Council that have occurred in the past few years. At the same time, I believe that our leading democracies are failing to speak openly of problems that they know about all too well, problems that they will tell you about when you meet with them. When I meet with governments and I say that we gave a human rights award to Yang Jianli, former political prisoner of China, who sat in isolation, was a survivor of Tiananmen Square massacre, and we promised him in giving him our human rights award that we would advocate for a resolution at the UN to speak for victims of China. And I met with a European diplomat from a leading European country, and I said to him, you know, now it was 1 year when China was off the Human Rights Council. I said, will you take action this year and introduce a resolution on China, as was tried 10 years before? They never could get the majority, but at least they would table it. They would put it on the table. They would get the spotlight. They would get the news headline. Again, the Human Rights Council, it's the power of turning the spotlight, the power of shaming an abuser, of turning a spotlight on abuses that would otherwise occur in darkness. And whether you pass the resolution or you don't, if you can manage to galvanize world attention by the very act of introducing the resolution, that in itself is something. And I said, Mr. Ambassador, will you consider this year raising a resolution on China? And his response was literally to laugh in my face. He literally started laughing. And he said, he stopped laughing and he said, who is going to introduce a resolution on the government of China? And so while it did happen 10 years before, either by the United States or some of the democracies in Europe, today, given the power of China, no one will ever dare to introduce a resolution on China. So when you meet the ambassadors and you say, can you take action for this situation? They'll tell you, I can't do it because the dictatorships are too powerful. But in their public documents, in their talking points, they don't say that. They say the Human Rights Council has shown once again how it is increased its efficiency and credibility and so forth. And in my view, they are failing to address very profound problems that affect the protection of human rights at the highest levels in the intergovernmental arena. And let me share with you a few of those problems that, in my opinion, are not being addressed. Number one, membership. Kofi Annan's first thing that he talked about was the membership. And indeed, there are 47 member states of the Human Rights Council. They have ambassadors who sit there in the room, but there's 47 member states. All other countries are present and participate in the discussions, but at the end of the session, only the member states vote. By the way, my organization, being an NGO, a non-governmental organization, having that status, we are entitled to be in the room and to speak, which is significant. And so the membership was supposed to improve, and indeed, we had a set of criteria. The current members today include Saudi Arabia, where women are subjugated systematically, where Raif Badawi, a blogger who called for a liberal society in Saudi Arabia, was thrown into prison, sentenced to 1,000 lashes, and given a 10-year prison sentence and fined. And it's a case that we're working on a lot. We gave him our Courage Award in Geneva together with 20 other human rights groups that co-organize our annual Geneva Summit for Human Rights. And you can learn more about it and see the testimonies at genevasummit.org. And our next conference will be on February 23rd in Geneva. You're all invited to participate. It's a wonderful event to meet with the most inspiring dissidents from some of the worst human rights situations on the planet, people who have gone to prison and sacrificed their own liberty, their own freedom, their own lives, in some cases, to speak out in defense of their human rights and those of their fellow people. And Raif Badawi sits in prison while his oppressor was elected as a member of the Human Rights Council and tried to be president. Saudi Arabia, we learned a few months ago, tried to be president. No one wanted to talk about it in Geneva. They wanted to keep it a secret. We sounded the alarm. And thankfully, we learned that they were blocked. However, Saudi Arabia was allowed to chair the group called the Consultative Group in June when they appointed experts. Experts of the United Nations, Saudi Arabia chaired the committee of five ambassadors deciding which experts on human rights to appoint. So if there's an expert interpreting women's rights, the one who appointed that expert, the head of that committee, was Saudi Arabia. Other members, China is a member. Vladimir Putin's Russia, a country that has that swallowed Crimea, trampled eastern Ukraine, has killed some 6,000 people, arrests a rock band, Pussy Riot, for criticizing the government. It's a member of the Human Rights Council. Indeed, China and Russia received, out of 193 possible votes at the General Assembly, they received, when they ran for a seat on the council, they received 176 seats. 176 out of 193, do the math, only 17 countries in the world declined to vote for Russia and China. How many members are in the EU? About 28 members. So that means that necessarily at least 11 members of the EU affirmatively voted, didn't abstain, didn't put a blank ballot, affirmatively voted for Vladimir Putin and the Chinese Communist Party to be sitting on the Human Rights Council. And at least 11, probably more. If you assume that the US, Canada, Australia, maybe New Zealand also chose not to vote for them, then maybe half the EU voted for China and Russia. And so not surprisingly, when these countries got elected, and when we sounded the alarm and went to New York City and brought victims of Vladimir Putin, we brought Masha Gessen, a gay rights activist who wrote the book on Vladimir Putin. We brought her to New York on the eve of the vote, and she said, please don't elect Russia. Do you know what message that sends to victims, to prisoners, when you elect their oppressor and declare them a judge of human rights around the world? And when we brought Rosa Maria Paya, whose father, Oswaldo Paya, was mysteriously killed in a car crash, which many believe was engineered by state police who were following him in the car. We brought her on the eve of the election. She said, don't elect the country that imprisoned my father, that tortured my father, that killed my father, and that beats human rights dissidents. Her father's only crime was asking for a constitution and rule of law in Cuba. And Cuba was elected as well. We brought Ali al-Ahmed, a dissident from Saudi Arabia, who implored the world not to elect Saudi Arabia. They too were elected. So the members today include Saudi Arabia, China, Russia, Cuba, Qatar, where thousands of migrant workers will die to build towers for the World Cup in the next several years. Slave labor, as many human rights activists call it. And these are the countries that dominate. They're not the only members. France and the UK and other democracies are members. But these countries too often dominate. And so, not surprisingly, many of these regimes and their allies get a free pass. Now, and as I said, it's enormously dispiriting if you're sitting in prison and you see the United Nations choose your oppressor and reward them. And you can see, and we track this, as soon as they're elected, the first thing they do is the state propaganda rushes to say the United Nations has elected our country, and they'll sometimes list the vote count if it's 176 out of 193, as a demonstration of how much confidence they have in our country. Gaddafi did the same thing in 2003. So it is used to provide false legitimacy to regimes that are unelected and abuse the human rights of their own people. I mentioned the UPR, the Universal Periodic Review Mechanism, and I said that it's a new mechanism. It's for the first time. Once every 4 years, you can talk about China. You can talk about Venezuela once every 4 years. So it has promise. It has hope. It means that at least one time in 4 years, that situation will be addressed. The problem is that most countries who are undertaking the review, it's not a review that's done by experts. It's not a review done by academics. It's a review done by fellow governments. So to understand how this works, we all gather for the Universal Periodic Review once every 4 years of Saudi Arabia, as we did a couple of years ago. And every country gets to speak for 1 or 2 minutes and to ask questions. And a number of democracies do ask meaningful questions addressing specific problems that amount to a challenge on that government's human rights record and helps advance the cause of human rights. But the vast majority, according to our figure, some 80%, and you can see our report online, it's entitled Mutual Praise Society. And the reason for that is because when Saudi Arabia was reviewed, China took the floor. China got up and said, we'd like to congratulate Saudi Arabia for their excellent record on religious freedom. Saudi Arabia, any religion other than Wahhabist Islam, Ali al-Ahmed, who challenged them, he's a Muslim, but he's not of the Wahhabi denomination. And he's Shiite, and his people were persecuted in Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia was praised for religious freedom a short time after they had elected some 50 Ethiopian Christians who were living in Saudi Arabia, whose crime was to have a Christian religious prayer service in a private home. In Saudi Arabia, they were arrested and put into prison for this crime, and they were being praised at the UPR of Saudi Arabia. The very next day, it was China's turn to be reviewed, and lo and behold, Saudi Arabia got up and said, Mr. President, we'd like to congratulate China for their excellent record on tolerance for ethnic minorities at a time when some 6,000 Buddhist temples have been destroyed in Tibet and monks are brutalized, let alone what's being done in the Xinjiang province against the Muslim minority there, the Uyghurs, against human rights champions like Liu Xiaobo, a writer who called for freedom and was sentenced to 11 years and was given the Nobel Prize but couldn't collect it, he or his wife, because he was in prison. And my board member, Yang Jianli, went to Oslo and collected the Nobel Prize for Liu Xiaobo. So the UPR has promise, but the vast majority of countries are misusing it. And what we did is we rated countries on how they use their few minutes, and the vast majority are misusing it and allowing countries to go home, back to Beijing, to Moscow, to Caracas, and say, we were reviewed, and guess what? 80% of the countries at the United Nations said how wonderful we are. And then it's put in a report, and then it's adopted. The only good thing I can say, apart from the handful of countries that do use it properly, is that in that one time, once every 4 years, when we address China, you can bring activists to Geneva, to the Human Rights Council, and there's media attention, and you can piggyback. So even though in the room, justice might not be happening, those who are clever and creative can figure out ways to use that occasion to put a spotlight on the situation, and that's something that NGOs have been able to do. Now, as I said, there's the UPR once every 4 years, but most countries are not afraid of the UPR. When Gaddafi, before he was killed in the war of 2011, when he was reviewed several months before, they were so comfortable going into the review. They had a cocktail party outside the review. They were giving out CDs of their wonderful human rights record and books, and there was no fear because the UPR is considered rote, and most of the questions are questions that they planted with their allies. and it doesn't inspire fear. What does inspire fear is when countries are singled out in a country resolution. That is very uncommon. It is atypical. And when that happens at a session, when there's a resolution on a country, that captures world attention, and the countries do everything they can to avoid being criticized, as I mentioned earlier. And so not surprisingly, what we see across the board is impunity. The vast majority of the world's worst abusers are never addressed in any resolution. So Saudi Arabia in the past several months, since March, has killed at least 2,000 civilians in Yemen. Some of them may have been killed by Houthis as well, but Saudi Arabia is leading a coalition that has been bombing. There's a war going on, a proxy war. The Houthis and Saudi Arabia and its coalition supporting its allies in Yemen, and they're bombing all the time. There's no UN resolution on that at all, on innocents being killed. There's no resolution on Saudi Arabia's treatment of women or religious minorities. They get a free pass. So does China, so does Russia, so does Cuba, Venezuela, Qatar, all the countries that are members, and their friends and allies. Algeria, Egypt, killed 1,000 people in one day. No resolution, no commission of inquiry, no emergency session, absolutely nothing. So if you go across the board, other than a handful of countries, those countries that are typically weak, isolated diplomatically, like North Korea, like Burma, Myanmar, and a few others, Syria had immunity for decades, but suddenly when they antagonized the Sunni Arab world, then there were resolutions on Syria. But the vast majority of countries get impunity. In the past 10 years, there have been 121 country resolutions. Of that, more than half, 62, were on one country alone, Israel. 59 on the rest of the world combined. So 62 on Israel, 59 on the rest of the world combined. I believe it's fine to criticize Israel as it is to criticize Palestinian groups like Hamas, Islamic Jihad, Fatah. But these resolutions only condemn Israel. They create commissions of inquiry where the verdict is delivered in advance. And unlike other resolutions, even when they have a resolution on Syria, Sudan, or other countries, they will have positive language for areas where that country is cooperating. These resolutions quite deliberately avoid any positive language whatsoever. And these resolutions are adopted and discussed under a special agenda item, especially on Israel. There's no agenda item on any other country. One final example of an area that is highly problematic is the experts of the UN. We have, as I mentioned, special rapporteurs. These are independent investigators who have the possibility to speak out for millions of victims around the world. A number of them do very good work. I mentioned one, Ahmed Shahid. I think he's doing an excellent job as special rapporteur on Iran. We also have good experts on freedom of assembly, on religious freedom, and other issues. However, because of the membership, because of the board of directors, are the regimes that I mentioned, you can be sure that they will use their power to appoint people that they like for very particular reasons. And I'll give you two examples. One is someone who was appointed a few months ago this year. His name is Idriss Jazeri. He used to be the Algerian ambassador at the Human Rights Council, and we all knew him as someone who was the public enemy number one of human rights victims, activists, and of human rights experts. He wanted to clip the wings of the experts who dare to criticize countries and governments like his. I think he was leader of the Islamic group. It was the Arab or Islamic group, but I think it was the Islamic group at the time, known as the OIC, Organization of Islamic Cooperation, they now call it. It used to be called the Organization of the Islamic Conference. And 56-nation body, very influential at the Human Rights Council. He was the head of it and wielded enormous power. Nothing could be done without his agreement. He created a code of conduct on experts whose only goal was to intimidate experts so that they wouldn't criticize countries. It was fiercely opposed by human rights groups and by the experts. And this year, he was appointed an expert himself, now having retired. Needless to say, that was not accepted very well by the independent experts. What was his mandate? The Cubans created a concept at the UN called unilateral coercive measures. That is UN speak for sanctions. And according to Cuba and its allies, that is against human rights. To have sanctions on a country is against human rights. And so they created a special rapporteur on this issue, and Idris Jazeri is now the mandate holder. He's someone who, if you review the things that he did during 5 years as leader of these governments, he tried to enforce the idea that any criticism of radical jihadist Islam is racism, what he called defamation of Islam, and he tried to change international law to amend the Convention on Racial Discrimination, the CERD, to amend it to make quote-unquote defamation of Islam a crime of racism. This gentleman mentioned his friends with David Litman, who passed away some 2-3 years ago. David Litman was a human rights activist for Christians in the Middle East. He was their most outspoken advocate. And David would speak about a Muslim figure in Egypt who was encouraging the genital mutilation of women. And when he tried to speak about that, the council went into chaos. The Egyptian said he must be stopped immediately. And the president of the Human Rights Council, there was mayhem. He took a pause for about an hour and he came back and the president said, issues of religion cannot be discussed at the Human Rights Council. Taboo. He was banned from talking about victims of female genital mutilation that were incited by a religious figure by the Human Rights Council. Even a leading UN figure, the High Commissioner at the time, Louise Arbour, had to criticize the action of the president of the Human Rights Council. A few days ago, if you were following Twitter of the UN Human Rights Council, you'll see that they're tweeting pictures of another expert who was sitting on the dais of the Human Rights Council. He is a member of the advisory committee, 18-member group called the think tank of the Human Rights Council. And he's been at the UN for 15 years, absent 1 year when he came off. But he's been there for 15 years, I think the longest serving expert on the Human Rights Council. His name is Jean Ziegler. He is a Swiss radical academic who, among other things, in 1989 announced to the world the creation of the Muammar Gaddafi Human Rights Prize. Jean Ziegler boasted about this prize. He said, the West has the Nobel Prize for wealthy people. What about the South? What about poor countries? Now we have the Gaddafi Prize. He said, yes, Gaddafi's not perfect, but he gave $10 million. It's in a Swiss bank account. I here in Geneva, he said, will monitor the money so it'll be used properly. Who has been given the award since then? Fidel Castro won the award. Hugo Chavez of Venezuela was given the award, $250,000, by the way. And in 2002, the award was given to convicted French Holocaust denier Roger Garaudy. In the same year that Jean Ziegler himself went to Tripoli, Libya, and received the award as well, the award that he helped create and announce to the world. Now, when I came to Geneva in 2004, and I saw Jean Ziegler holding forth, he was then the expert on hunger, he denied having anything to do with this prize. He said it never happened. And he told the media it's a lie that I invented. And I said, well, it's in Time magazine and five other newspapers quoting him, announcing it to the world. And for 10 years, he denied it. 2 years ago, we found video on the internet of all the prize winners, including at minute 2, you'll see Jean Ziegler coming up to the podium and as they put the award around his neck, the Gaddafi Prize, 29 September 2002. I called the press conference 2 years ago as he was about to be reelected again. On that Monday, we showed the video. He was exposed, and they went to him, and they said, Mr. Ziegler, because he's well-known in Switzerland, what's your response? He said, well, of course I received the prize. I always said I received the prize. He didn't for 10 years. He was exposed. He said, yes, I received the award, but then I gave it back 2 days later. It's unclear if he meant the physical medallion or the $250,000. He didn't give any details, and he wasn't asked. A few days later, the election was held. Jean Ziegler was elected by a strong majority of the Human Rights Council. So these are what we're up against, and sadly, the democracies don't want to talk about it. You know, you meet with them and you say, do a resolution on China, and they say, I can't, because they're so strong. But in their talking points, they don't mention the reality that so much cannot be done. So briefly, because I'm running out of time, but what is to be done? Our organization is present at the Human Rights Council. It's not going away, the Human Rights Council. Its principles, as established by Eleanor Roosevelt, are noble. And we have to fight to make this work the way it should be. And as I mentioned on a number of occasions, it can work when the right majority is assembled. And it's very hard work. Diplomats have to step up to the plate. The work that we do is we bring victims to speak. You know, the UN also offers an opportunity to be an NGO and to speak in front of the Syrian ambassador, the Chinese ambassador, the Pakistani ambassador. There's nowhere else in the world you can do that other than at the Human Rights Council. And so we bring victims to take the floor and speak. And that's enormously empowering for these people, especially when their oppressors are sitting there in those positions. And I was asked earlier today, is it not depressing to be in this situation where human rights is turned on its head, where it's sort of an Orwellian universe? And it is very depressing. But we have the privilege of meeting such inspiring people, whether it's Masih Alinejad from Iran, who speaks out for women's rights, whether it's Yang Zhenli, I mentioned before, of China, Alex Chow, a young man from Hong Kong. We brought two leaders of the Hong Kong student protest to speak. Eusebio Acosta, young activist from Venezuela who was had a tent camp in Caracas. We meet amazing people, courageous individuals, and that really gives us the strength to keep on, because they tell you it's important. And Yang Zhenli, the political prisoner, former political prisoner, says that his spirit was broken in solitary confinement, but when he learned eventually, finally, that his got some mail, that people were speaking out for him, suddenly his back straightened and he had the will to continue. So it's vital that we continue to speak out. What we want our elected leaders to do is to begin by telling the truth. If we want to fix the problem, it doesn't work by sweeping it under the rug and saying that everything works out. So we want our governments to acknowledge the problems, even if there's no magical solution. It's a political body. That's the paradox. It means so much because it's a governmental body, but diplomats, government representatives, are often the worst people to take on other governments. It's not in the nature of diplomats to confront other governments. They would rather be diplomatic. But we demand that our governments use this forum the way it was supposed to work, to introduce resolutions even if they'll fail. Even if you only get 12 out of 47, you can put the spotlight on the situation, call an emergency session, and give a voice for victims. And if they do that, we believe in the 10th anniversary next year and the years beyond, we can live up to the legacy of Eleanor Roosevelt. Thank you very much.
Hillel Nour is the executive director of United Nations Watch, and he recently briefed the University of Auckland Politics Department about the United Nations Human Rights Council.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Leonardo Alanis, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armoodian, and we'll see you next week.